Discover the surprises. For more information and tickets, go to festivalnuitdafrique.com.
Good day, everybody. This is an event hosted by a number of organizations looking at the situation in occupied Palestine today. This is a live broadcast on CKUT, and our event today is Human Rights in Palestine, New Perspectives on International Solidarity. This is a webinar hosted by Alternatives here in Montreal in collaboration with a number of organizations, and we're, as mentioned, broadcasting live on CKUT. I'll go over all of the details in terms of the speakers and sponsoring organizations in a moment, but first of all, I will just pass the mic to Catherine Papas, who's the director of Alternatives here in Montreal, and it's also a global organization, for you to share with us a bit about Alternatives and a land acknowledgement.
Bonjour tout le monde et bienvenue. Mon nom est Catherine Papas, je travaille avec Alternatives à Montréal. Ce matin, le webinaire aura lieu en anglais avec interprétation vers le français. Si vous souhaitez suivre la présentation en français, je vous invite à choisir le bouton d'interprétation au bas de votre écran. I would like to begin by acknowledging that the broadcast of this webinar is located on unceded Indigenous lands. The Kanien Nation is recognized as the custodians of the lands and waters on which we gather today. Totiake, Montreal, is historically known as a gathering place for many First Nations. Today, it is home to a diverse population of Indigenous and other peoples. My name is Catherine Papas. I work for Alternatives, an international solidarity organization in Montreal. Since 1994, solidarity with the Palestinian struggle has been central to our work. For almost 27 years, we've joined our voices to Palestinian civil society and other groups and activists from around the world to call for an end to the Israeli occupation, the violent and discriminatory apartheid regime, and to the systematic violations of the rights of Palestinians. I traveled to Palestine for the first time in 2006, a few weeks after the start of what was sadly called Operation Summer Rains. As I was going through Erez to cross over to Gaza, I remember hearing the sound of a blast that seemed surprisingly close. Somehow to reassure me, a Canadian journalist walking next to me explained that it was just a sonic bomb, nothing to worry about, a tactic by Israel to cause fear and stress among Palestinian population. These sound bombs cause damages in walls and windows and particularly affect young children who develop all sorts of stress syndromes. Some children start pulling out strands of hair each time one of these pretend bombs go off. Throughout the year that I spent in Palestine, beyond the illegality of the occupation, the oppression, the violence, the dire economic situation that the occupation has brought about on people, what was most troubling was this very sophisticated system that was established by Israel to humiliate Palestinians and to rob them of their dignity. Every day, we see Palestinians being turned back at checkpoints or taken off buses for routine controls. Sometimes we hear of women giving birth at roadblocks because Israeli military wouldn't let the car go through. Last May, Israel's heavy bombardment of Gaza sparked an outrage all over the world. But the pattern is all too familiar. Israel bombs until the international outcry over civilian casualties demands an end to the operation. And so it goes from Operation Summer Rains to Operation Autumn Cloud to Operation Hot Winter and so on. Earlier this year, Human Rights Watch released a report showing that the Israeli authorities are committing crimes against humanity of apartheid and persecution. This very documented report shows systematic oppression and institutional discrimination against Palestinians. Nothing of this is new. The BDS movement has been saying it ever since its formation. Concrete action needs to be taken to end international support for Israel's oppression of Palestinians and pressure Israel to comply with international law. But as the title of the report says, a threshold was crossed. We can't simply maintain the fiction that the peace process is still active or that it ever was. And this should give some hope to the Palestinian struggle and to Palestinian people because justice needs to be delivered. I'd like to thank Stefan Christophe and CKUT for co-hosting today's event, as well as the interpreter Daniel Hollick and our Emil Dror, Samira Iskanda, Mustafa Henaway, Michael Link, and Jesse Steen. Have a nice webinar.
Thank you, Catherine, and Alternatives for co-hosting this event. I'm Stefan Christophe in Montreal. We are broadcasting live on CKUT, community radio here in the city. As mentioned by Catherine, there are speakers, a number of speakers today, who are representing various efforts to highlight Palestinian human rights in different parts of the world. So I will not read all the bios, but each time we are hearing a presentation, I will share a brief bio about the speaker we're about to hear. So thank you again for joining this webinar, Human Rights in Palestine, New Perspectives on International Solidarity. First, we're going to be hearing from Emmanuel Dror, who is a biophysicist and is a member of the International Commission of the Union Syndicale Solidaire and of the BDS campaign in France, where Dror works on campaigns related to both unions, the academic sphere, and cultural issues. Dror is joining us from Paris, where he's been organizing for many years in support of Palestinian human rights. So thank you so much, Dror, for sharing an update. I know that the BDS campaign has been very active in France over the recent months. So I look forward to hearing from you as to where things are at today.
Thank you very much, Stefan. Thank you for Alternative for this very promising cycle of webinars, and this one particularly about Palestine. Thank you for letting me present the BDS campaign in France, the Campagne BDS France, which is an example out of many chapters of the campaign all throughout the world. So the Campagne BDS France is the French chapter to the Palestinian Call of 2005. There's about 60 national organizations, unions, and parties in the BDS France campaign, in addition to 70 local chapters in different cities throughout France. So like any other BDS campaign, it organizes campaign for boycott, divestment, and sanction, and in various fields. So it could be economic boycott, cultural, academic, sports boycott, or also devoted to military embargo, etc. Of course, I will remind it, because I'm the first one to speak, that this is a campaign until Israeli complies with international law, human rights, and Palestinian rights, including those of Palestinian refugees outside of Israel, historic Palestine, until they return to their home. So the Campagne BDS France partly reacts to the news, but it also holds long-standing campaigns. The current ones are mostly divestment campaigns that are targeting either the German sports equipment brand Puma, because it is the official Israeli national soccer team provider. And also the other current big target is the French insurance company AXA, because it subsidizes many projects that are taking place inside the settlements of the 1967 occupied territories. But today I'm going to focus on the cultural boycott campaign of the Campagne BDS France. I want to outline what we've been doing in that field. It's again probably similar to what's happening in other countries with some specificities due to the situation in France. So the cultural boycott, as you know, is not one that hurts Israel on economically much. It's a campaign that is very powerful in that it hurts the reputation of Israel. And Israel is very keen on having a reputation of an educated, enlightened, modern, Western culture country. It actually spends millions of euros trying to whitewash its crime by subsidizing cultural events and artists and exporting those events throughout the world. By the way, by doing so, it confirms that art is political and it's used by Israel as a political tool, something that Palestinians knew all along. So our goal is to counteract this propaganda, to refuse to let Israeli use culture to hide its crime, and also to refuse to treat Israel as a normal country until it complies with international law. Another thing about cultural boycott, it's also special as in the fact that it aims at artists. It talks to artists, and through that, it also talks to their fans and followers. So it can, by targeting or talking to artists, it reaches millions of people. And when artists themselves publicly talk, they talk to millions of people. And also, sometimes this crowd of followers is, because it's a different channel than politics, is a different crowd to talk to than the one we used to. It's probably different and probably a younger crowd that we're talking to. Now, to get to the campaign itself, I will say that we have three types of action that fall into the cultural boycott campaign. One, the first one would be French events that happen in Israel, for example, French artists that go to Israel to perform. So I will take one example, the French musician Titi Robin. He was invited to play at the Jerusalem Sacred Music Festival in 2014. And this is a musician that had played several times in Israel before and in Palestine, but he has ties and friends and colleagues that he plays with in Israel. But this time, this was 2014, it was too much right after the war in Gaza, he refused to go. In addition, the Jerusalem Sacred Music Festival happens in occupied Jerusalem, and there's many other reasons not to go there. But the interesting thing is the first time he decided to pull out was the beginning of a reflection for him. And after that, he has strengthened his position. And this year, he has signed the Musicians for Palestine letter in 2021, pledging not to play there. So that's a way to see that how an event can have consequences in the long run. Another event that I want to talk about is the Eurovision that happened in 2019 in Israel. And there was a huge campaign in France. And for some, it could be a failure because there's no French artist that canceled his or her participation to the Eurovision. But to our, in our opinion, it was a huge success because the mobilization drew over 100 French artists, some famous one, that signed an appeal for artists not to participate in Eurovision and for the Eurovision not to take place in Israel. And this was the largest artist list expressing support for Palestine in France ever. And again, each one of these artists spread the information to their followers through social networks. So even if the artists that we are talking to end up going, those campaigns are, we've noticed on the BDS France website that these articles are the one who draw the largest amount of people, the largest traffic on the website. Again, because this is about culture and this is talking to a much wider sphere than politics. Nevertheless, this is still politics because talking about culture and talking to people interested about culture, we nevertheless talk about Palestine, use our own narrative about Palestine, about apartheid, about occupation, colonization, about BDS, and we're this way spreading information and doing popular education in a way. Another thing is one may think that the recent lack of recent victories, this can be misleading, because by now it's been 15 years that the BDS campaign is going on, and there's a long list of artists that have either already boycotted, or there's what's called a silent boycott, people who tell Israeli organizers that they won't participate to their festival without saying it publicly, or just artists that are known to boycott Israel. And for this reason, those artists are no longer even contacted to perform in Israel. So we don't hear them about them canceling, but that's because they've canceled ahead of time. So the list is longer than what appears from a mere list of annual victories that we have. So that's the first type of action that we have. The second type is the reverse one, is when Israeli events happen in France. So, of course, I'm not talking about Israeli artists. As you know, Israeli artists are not BDS target. We're not asking to boycott Israeli artists. We're talking about the participation of official Israeli institutions in events that happen in France. So there are several examples. One example is the, for example, of a successful campaign in France was the International Comics Festival in Angoulême, which is one of the most famous and one of the largest festivals of its kind in the world. And in 2014 and 2015, it was sponsored by SodaStream, the Israeli company. So there was a huge campaign. In the end, we managed to unite over 160 cartoonists from 20 countries around the world. And after 2 years, the Angoulême gave in and kicked SodaStream out. So another example, of course, is Israeli festivals, cultural festivals in France that are there to promote Israel as a country. And on a side note, those festivals are usually annual, so they're easy to, it's easy for us to organize annually because we know when they're going to occur. One last point about this, which is not so much about France, but we have to pay attention because what happens in other countries can spread to other countries, is the backlash that artists have experienced in Germany, because artists who are open BDS supporters have been sometimes, their invitations have been canceled by German festivals. So luckily this hasn't spread yet on a wider range. And also some of these decisions have been reversed after powerful campaigns. But this is something that we have to worry about. The right to boycott is also a campaign that may be necessary. And so I've talked about French events in Israel or Israeli events in France. The last aspect I want to talk about is what I call the flip of the coin, is the fact that the very existence of Israel is attempting to erase Palestinian culture and Palestinian culture history. And so as BDS organizers and activists, we have to also support Palestinian and pro-Palestinian cultural events all over the world, and particularly in France. So this also means promoting Palestinian artists, Palestinian culture, Palestinian participation in festivals. But also, and that's sometimes a topic that's hard to explain, fighting against the normalization, this type of thing of inviting one Palestinian and one Israeli artist to pretend to promote peace. War is not over. There is no symmetry. There still is an oppressor and an oppressed. And until the invited Israeli artist recognizes the current injustices and fights against it along with the Palestinian artist, this attempt to normalize should absolutely be boycotted. Again, because those festivals are annual, I'm talking about cultural events in France that are not sponsored by Israel, but that want to maybe invite Palestinian artists, we can talk to them and warn them about this normalization risk. And we've learned that it's more efficient to have those discussions with the festival organizer ahead of time rather than doing it after the program has been published. So that's a suggestion for groups if you run into this kind of problem. So this is what we've been doing in France. It's probably similar in other countries. Some specificities about France. You may know that BDS in France is not easy. BDS activists in France have faced many trials. Most of them have been won. I don't know if that's known, but it's still exhausting to have those trials and go to court, and you know, and it's expensive and it takes time and you lose days of salaries, etc. Recently, the European Human Rights Court has confirmed that boycotting for political reason is legal in Europe, so in France too. Nevertheless, it remains difficult. Cultural boycott, on the other hand, because it's symbolic, has never been, doesn't fall under the law. It has never been targeted by trials. Nobody has ever been tried for cultural boycott events. The problem is not so much there in the cultural field, it's to get to the mainstream. So I'm going to take a second to talk about the most recent action, the Musicians for Palestine letter that probably Jesse's going to talk about in details later. But many international musicians have signed it, including musicians that are famous in France, including famous French musicians. I'm going to name a few: Elie Medeiros, Titi Robin, Moussé Hakim, Ashka, Kenny Arcana, Medine. Those are very famous, even for mainstream media. Nevertheless, and actually, international journals have mentioned it. Even in Israel, journals have mentioned it. But in France, there's no major newspaper that have mentioned this letter. And this is typical of a self-censorship, of not wanting to deal with the subject. I mean, for the sake of completion, there are three small and independent websites, Combini, Révolution Permanente, and Middle East Eye, mostly activist or political or specialized in the Middle East websites that have mentioned it, but no big outlet. So I guess our next goal is to break into the mainstream media. I don't want to end on that negative note. So speaking of the future, I want to end with one idea of campaign that we've had in France and that I've actually talked about with Samir, and that is still kind of open. We haven't really started because we don't know where to take it from, but I'm just going to put it out for discussion. Recently, Israel has been investing a lot of money in series, television series or series for internet platforms such as Netflix. Those series promote a nice view of Israel, a distorted view of Israel. They also distort the truth when they want to allude to the political situation in Israel in those movies. So it's a challenge for us. What can we do with this? It's not in the street. We can't pick it. How can we target them? We can try to convince people not to watch them, but how can we know about this? Can we convince actors not to play in them? Can we convince platforms not to pay for them? It's really open question that we don't have answers for yet. Israeli propaganda has adapted to new technologies. And so we as activists also have to adapt our strategies. And so I will leave you with this to think about, and I'm looking forward to hear what other people have to say. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Emmanuel Dror, who's speaking to us from Paris. Dror is a biophysicist, member of the International Commission of the Union Syndicale Solidaire of the BDS France campaign also, where he works on campaigns related to unions, the academic sphere, and cultural issues. Hearing Dror's presentation here on this event, we are participating in an event, Human Rights in Palestine Today, New Perspectives on International Solidarity. I think that it's really important to underline the multitude of work going on around the world. And that's one thing we are trying to highlight with this panel, is just the sheer number of worlds that are existing as part of this global movement for Palestinian human rights, which is really actually overwhelming in the sense that there's so much organizing that is happening at a grassroots level globally. And we'll just hear about a small amount of that today, but at least I hope this is a window into some of the efforts happening globally. This is being broadcast on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. The next speaker is Mustafa Hanawi, who is a longtime community organizer at the Immigrant Worker Center here in Montreal. It's a frontline organization that supports migrant workers and is deeply involved in the movement for status for all. Mustafa also works with Labor for Palestine and Academics for Palestine and has been involved in a number of organizations in support of Palestinian liberation, including Tadamon, and was involved in the launching of Israeli Apartheid Week globally. Mustafa, thank you so much for being here, and the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Stefan, and thank you very much to CKUT as well as Alternatives, which also I'm a member of the Board of Administrations of Alternatives. So, and it's really a kind of the timing is perfect to have such a conversation about the idea of thinking through the new perspectives on BDS, and particularly where we stand now and maybe where we stood 15 years ago, right? And I think we're at a watershed moment that was very different prior to this summer. And I think a lot of it is a result of kind of the work that has led up to this moment. And so Labor for Palestine, one organization that I've been part of, is a network that began after 2006, after one of the first major trade unions, a Canadian Union of Public Employees in Ontario, had adopted boycott, divestment, and sanctions resolution. Mama. It faced major backlash from the Israeli lobby, from conservative elements within the Ontario government, but it opened a major door in terms of getting the trade union movement to take on its role to back boycott, divestment, and sanctions, right? And we saw in Quebec, the first union was actually FNEC, the teachers union at the CEGEP level, which is a federation within the CSN, had adopted boycott, divestment, and sanctions. It was the most progressive unions, right? It was the Conseil National Metropolitan Montréal, which was the first also trade union federation at a city level that adopted a BDS resolution. And where I'm going with this is that we had seen an escalation, not only in Israeli violence and in Israeli aggression and Israeli, we've also seen an escalation in terms of the solidarity. And I think, unfortunately, and I think this is something that people faced within the trade union movement, but particularly academics faced a particular backlash with the IHRA, or what happened with the Trade Union Congress and the Labour Party in the United Kingdom, right? That there was a strategy on part to actually undermine Palestine solidarity through the use of the IHRA definition on anti-Semitism, right? And I think it put us back in a way where we were on the defensive just to defend the right to be in solidarity with Palestine, just to defend the right to do BDS and not actually doing BDS. But I think we saw that change with Sheikh Jarrah and what happened in Gaza this past summer. I think we've never seen a watershed movement in terms of the level of mobilization and the spontaneity of the mobilization, I think had been the biggest in recent memory. And I think one of the dynamics at play, I think now what we're seeing in the Palestine movement globally is that there was always a disjuncture between what was taking place in the solidarity movement and what was taking place in Palestine. People were saying, you know, that the movement was weak inside Palestine, but there was quite a bit of solidarity and there was always this disjuncture. And I think now we have this really dynamic moment where you actually are seeing an incredible mobilization inside all parts of Palestine, which was not witnessed before, right? This was in 48, the demonstrations that were taking place, but also the repression in historic Palestine, also the demonstrations taking place at the border between of Palestinians marching from the camps to the border in Lebanon or in Jordan, to now the nightly demonstrations taking place at the settlement outpost. So we're seeing this huge outpouring of all forms of popular resistance in Palestine that need to be supported, right? And I think, and now we're seeing this, you know, we saw the letter, the Musicians for Palestine, but most recently, which no one thought would be possible in the Canadian context, was actually the Canadian Labour Congress, the largest labour organization in Canada, representing over 3 million workers, unanimously adopting a resolution calling for an embargo on arms sales to Israel, right? And calling for a limited BDS campaign. Also at the same, we saw this resolution passed at the NDP. And I think, so I think these two, sorry everyone. And so when we're looking at these two, these two moments, the question I think concretely what we're facing is in the Canadian context or in the Quebec context, where do we go with particular campaigns? How do we actually hold everyone to account to actually sort of channel all of that energy that's been garnished now, that with the mass mobilizations, with the ability to actually have all of these resolutions passed in all different sectors within the universities, within trade unions. And I just want to highlight maybe a few campaigns that really should be thought through or are thought about, because, you know, when we're talking about BDS, we're actually moving towards the S part of the BDS, right? We're moving towards the question of sanctions, the questions of divestment, but also a question of strategy, right? And I think one of the few things particularly that we've seen trade unions heavily involved in the West Coast in the United States, and also talk within British Columbia, is the longest blockade of any ship, right? Which is the Zim ship, an Israeli cargo ship that was first blocked at the port in South Africa, then in Italy, then in Oakland. And so this is a campaign that's really put forward a lot of grassroots momentum to actually concretely put up that picket line. That so there's questions here in terms of the Montreal context, that there should be a declaration of unions who work at the ports to actually say that ship will not be able to unload at the port of Montreal, or whether it be in Halifax, right? That it this is one campaign, and that's been effective in terms of, and now we're seeing this, you know, Israeli ships have to fly under different flags of convenience. The other campaign, in terms of thinking through about, you know, Israeli crimes against Palestinians and sort of Israel's war machine, and the role of labor and the role of public institutions has been that of G4S, right? And G4S, many have known, is an English, or was, a London global security company, right? That was heavily involved in Israeli checkpoints and was heavily involved in surveillance and the Israeli prison system, right? Which is key to the function of apartheid. And G4S was actually purchased by Allied Security. And people who don't know, just to make the link, Allied Security is actually owned wholly by, it's a subsidiary of Caisse de dépôt et placement de Québec. It is the world's largest security firm, is actually a public entity of Quebec in sorts. So I think this is a really important campaign to highlight, because we can mobilize, and this is all of Quebec's pension. 6 million Quebec people in Quebec pay into this, right? So I think this is a campaign that should resonate with the trade unions, and we shouldn't be investing in apartheid and profiting from apartheid collectively as a society. You know, through the Canada-Israel Free Trade Agreement, one of the things that we're beginning to see is these small niche companies prop up, and we're beginning to see, you know, there's funding for research, particularly on militarism, which is taking place across campuses. And one of the things that has been set up is not just through CIFTA, which is the Canada-Israel Research and Financing and Training Fund, but also what's been called the Canada-Israel Infrastructure Fund, right? Which is a fund, an investment platform that allows Canadian institutional investors to invest in Israeli infrastructure projects, right? And so these projects in particular also solidify Israeli apartheid in a concrete way. The LRT in East Jerusalem, right? Which has also played a role by Bombardier, solidifies what Jeff Halper calls the matrix of apartheid, right? That slowly to eat up East Jerusalem and to integrate the settlements in East Jerusalem with West Jerusalem, much like the highway system inside the West Bank, which is to integrate it within the settlements within Israel, right? So Canada isn't simply a junior partner in its support for Israeli apartheid. And I think we need to think through strategies to actually channel all of that mobilization and energy that can hold the Liberal government to account. And obviously it's no easy task when it, you know, this is the same regime that won't allow for an actual independent national inquiry into the genocide of Indigenous children. Why would we expect it to do the same around Palestine? But we have, I think, a kind of momentum to hold them account on and to make these grassroots gains. And so I'll leave it at that, and apologies for the background noise.
Thank you so much, Mustafa Hanawi, for sharing your perspectives and all support for the background discussion involved in your presentation also. This is a conference hosted by Alternatives, Human Rights in Palestine Today, New Perspectives on International Solidarity. This is also a live broadcast on CKUT 90.3 FM Community Radio here in Montreal. I'm Stefan Christoph. I host the program Free City Radio. I just wanted to underline again the multitude of efforts that have happened and are happening right now in support of Palestinian human rights, and how those efforts and mobilizations exist within a broader world of struggles for freedom, struggles for human rights, and the ways that the struggle for Palestinian liberation can open windows for us to think differently about the economic structures of our society, banks and investments, and how they contribute to systemic injustice. And I think that's the point of the Caisse de dépôt's investment in allied security underlined by Mustafa. It's very important. The next speaker is Jesse Stein, who's a musician and geographer living and working in Montreal and New York City. She's a member of the Luyas and a signatory to the Musicians for Palestine Initiative. Jesse's also a PhD candidate at the City University of New York Graduate Center. So Jesse's joining us from New York today. Hi, Jesse, and thanks so much for your presence.
Hello, and thank you so much for having me. So yes, as Stefan mentioned, I'm speaking today from New York City, which is the traditional unceded Lenape land, and today home to people who think of themselves from every scrap of earth on the planet. Which is not to say in any way that it's an uncontested space today or one where justice is achieved, of course, but rather to highlight how it's one of among many places from which we can think seriously about violent dispossession, about land theft, group differentiation in the social, economic, political, and cultural realms. And it's a place to think about how to fight for some justice in the heterogeneous present with all of its architecture of power asymmetries. So thank you to my esteemed co-panelists and friends, and to Free City Radio, CKUT, and Alternative for having me. I'm here today as a representative and signatory to the Musicians for Palestine letter. So I thought I'd tell you a little bit about the letter, and then we can turn to some thoughts on human rights and solidarity. So Musicians for Palestine, is a letter, or began as a letter, has begun as a letter, that was launched on May 27th. And the letter is based on the idea of refusing silence, on the incontrovertible fact of the violence of the occupation and oppression in Palestine, and in solidarity with the demonstrations and popular resistance in Palestine itself. And the letter articulated a commitment to refusing silence about the then and still recent Israeli bombardment, which killed over 245 people just this spring, refusal of silence around the dispossession, forced eviction that people were experiencing and continued to have to fight from their homes in Sheikh Jarrah, which at the time was experiencing a real groundswell of protests, which continues, a refusal of silence on the longstanding denial of the right to return for people who had been cast out of their homelands violently and left so many members of the Palestinian diaspora stateless, displaced, and without recourse. A call in the letter for stopping the funding of technologies that maintain apartheid, oppression, and specifically military action on behalf of the various governments that claim to represent us wherever we, the signatories, exist in the world. And as well, I think there was also a refusal of silence on, of course, ethnic cleansing, systemic violence, racist, social, legal, cultural infrastructures, which amount to persecution of a huge swath of human beings on this planet and the denial of their self-determination. So we situate our call for solidarity in this, in a broader anti-colonial struggle, and call on musicians to take the material step of refusing to perform in complicit cultural institutions, and insisting on the importance of public assertions of solidarity as well. So with this letter, signatories hope to lift up Palestinian musicians and the message of Palestinian people in their struggle for liberation. So the letter circulated and was signed by a fairly large number of international musicians. Over 600 people signed the initial call. Some of them were rather famous, and some of them were working locally, but all of them release music, perform. Some notable names include A-Track, Asia Monet, Belly, Black Thought and Questlove from the Roots. We had Patti Smith, Nicholas Jarre, Serge Tankian from System of a Down, Rage Against the Machine, Thurston Moore from Sonic Youth, Tim Hecker, Talib Kweli, Toon Yards, Run the Jewels. So many internationally recognized artists signed this letter, but just as importantly, the distribution of the people who decided that they wanted to lend their voice to this call was geographically extremely vast. There were people from, I believe, every continent save the polar continents that signed this letter. I'm pretty sure. I'm almost certain. And certainly people from different linguistic communities and extremely different positionings geographically, in terms of genre, in terms of what they make and the way that their music circulates. So that was really interesting. And all of these people who decided to sign this letter, were signing a statement that unequivocally supports the human rights of Palestinians. So when I think about what this letter aimed to do or potentially could continue to do as a network of people who've made a certain commitment to keep their cultural work out of specific settings and to continue to advocate for Palestinian liberation, is what can this work do specifically from the position of one's occupation as a musician? Like, what can musicians add to the important existing efforts to use human rights and the mechanisms of international law or economic mechanisms to confront Israel on its atrocious disregard for Palestinian life? So this is something that I think is kind of interesting. And as Dror highlighted in his excellent talk about cultural boycott in France, the withdrawal of cultural capital, which is to say the refusal to play in certain spaces or the refusal to endorse certain politics that we deem unjust, functions as a reputational rather than a meaningful economic threat. But that reputational threat is important. And George spoke so well to that, but I would also like to say that it also potentially functions as a profound resource for consciousness shifting work, and particularly in a landscape where there is so much propaganda, where there is so much obfuscation, using our fora as musicians who exist in all sorts of different worlds on this planet is potentially extremely powerful. So on a basic level, musicians know how to make noise. So many people are first prompted to reconsider the political because an artist they admire invites them into an unfamiliar world or offers an explicit political message, or alternatively is just able to redescribe a political constellation in such a way that the humanity behind it and the human cost of inaction are possible to connect with through both head and heart. So this is in no way to say that music is an inherent social good. Music can be used in all sorts of ways. We know this, but rather to acknowledge that its connecting potential and its ability to reframe are powerful tools to prompt inquiry. And for many, they shape the way that we form our consciousness around issues, or at least provoke certain kinds of questions that allow us to dig deeper into the powerful and extremely important organizing work that's happening in different social justice groupings, and particularly around this question of Palestine. We also can turn to the sort of historical efficacy of musicians standing up against apartheid. So I'm thinking, of course, about Artists United Against Apartheid in the struggle against apartheid in South Africa, and the fact that they were able to garner support and shift consciousness around that particular moment, in that time, in that place. Now, we cannot make the mistake of imagining these two times and spaces as perfect translations of one another, nor can we make the mistake of imagining that the way that the politics works to stabilize these both instances of profound asymmetries of power are the same or can be fought with exactly the same tools. At the same time, we have much to learn from how musicians from around the world stood up and respected the demands made by South Africans who advocated a cultural boycott at that time. And we can think about the demands that are being made by Palestinian civil society and try to live up to what they're telling us and to truly listen. So the kind of connecting work that we can do, and in an internationalist perspective, is not only about drawing attention to the places that may seem far away. For me, sitting in New York or when I'm home in Montreal, Palestine may seem very far. But it also calls on us to do the work of bridging struggles that may be happening thousands of kilometers away into conversations with those things that are happening in our immediate geographic vicinity. And this is the kind of work that musicians who are implicated in their own settings can do. It's a bottom-up pressure that's crucial to contesting the false view that places are entirely discrete, because power doesn't operate on exclusively a local basis. And histories that animate spaces may be particular to times and places, but they're also forged and maintained, as is in the case in Palestine today, across wider scales. And this is why it's so important that we draw attention to the way that free trade agreements are functioning. And we'll have, I think, more discussion on that a little bit later. But also how in different geographies and with our different access to different places, we might have some rhizomatic potential to make connections that make the problems in Palestine and the fight that must continue there legible and important in these spaces, such as Canada or the United States, where that power structure is maintained. So I think I'm going to pretty much leave it there. I just want to end by saying that when we commit to revoking our cultural capital from institutions that are complicit in war crimes, and when we demand that the nation states to which we belong or have nationality live up to the legal and ethical commitments they purport to hold in our names, that is one form of solidarity work that we can do that hopefully can help in this wider struggle. And I think that it's important that we remember the power of cultural work, not only as it exists in the economic realm, but also how it can help illuminate the connections across spaces, not only so that we can revoke our complicity in maintaining injustice, but also so that we can understand how, for example, in Canada, the continued dispossession of Indigenous people, the revocation of their lands, I'm thinking specifically of the ongoing fight in Gana-Sitake, is connected to and maintained by similar structures as the dispossession that happens in Sheikh Jarrah, as the bombs that drop in Gaza. They're not the same, but we can think about these things together in really important ways. Thank you very much.
Thank you to Jesse Stein, who's a musician and geographer who lives and works between Montreal and New York, who's a musician with the group The Luyas and is a signatory for Musicians for Palestine. Jesse is a PhD candidate at the City University of New York Graduate Center. This is a panel discussion hosted by Alternatives, and we're looking at different voices around the world in relation to Palestinian human rights globally and the various efforts to underline and to draw attention to the urgency of speaking out about the situation in Palestine. I want to just quickly say that we're thinking of the Jarrah family today, and specifically just wanted to note and to say that we're thinking of Suha Jarrah and, of course, Halida Jarrah, who's still a political prisoner in Palestine. I'm Stefan Christoph, and this is Human Rights in Palestine Discussion. Samir Askanda is a Palestinian musician and activist who's very active with the BDS movement. Samir is based in the UK and has worked on many global BDS campaigns, particularly around the cultural boycott. I know Samir is also active on various efforts to highlight the interconnections of social justice movements. Samir, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. Thank you, Stefan. Thank you to the hosts of this event, my fellow panelists for their enlightening talks, and to the listeners and viewers. This year, Palestinians across every inch of historic Palestine rose against more than 100 years of settler colonialism, against more than seven decades of forced displacement and ethnic cleansing, against more than 50 years of military occupation in the West Bank and Gaza, against the brutal siege of Gaza, and against Israel's repeated and ongoing massacres in Gaza that killed more than 240 Palestinians, including more than 60 children in May. As Palestinians rose across every inch of historic Palestine, we too, in the global north and around the world, came together to stand in meaningful solidarity with the Palestinian people in the struggle for liberation in historic Palestine and in the diaspora. And as Palestinians stand united together as an oppressed people resisting Israel's regime of apartheid, and it is apartheid, as Human Rights Watch and the largest Israeli human rights organization, B'Tselem, have this year reported in detail, confirming what Palestinians, South Africans, and many others have long said. We ask the world to be as courageous as the Palestinian people in this urgent moment of crisis, as courageous as the Palestinian youth facing off Israel's militarized forces that are backed to the hilt by the US, the UK, the EU, and other powers. As Palestinians marked 73 years of the Nakba catastrophe, 73 years of forced expulsions, 73 years of apartheid, brutalization, massacres, and pogroms that have never stopped, we ask the world to take meaningful, principled, and courageous actions in solidarity with our struggle for liberation and justice. This year, like never before, the world has responded. The Palestinian Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel documented the more than 300 academic departments, programs, centers, unions, and societies that have endorsed statements in support of Palestinian rights. Similar statements from individual researchers, scholars, university staff, student and alumni have garnered more than 15,000 signatures. In Canada, more than 2,800 healthcare workers, researchers, scholars and students denounced Israel's destruction of medical facilities and the killing of Palestinian physicians and healthcare workers in Gaza, and called on the Canadian government to end its military support to Israel. Countless athletes, teams, and sports stars have also expressed solidarity with Palestinians in recent months. Dozens of new apartheid-free zones have sprung up around the world, including sports teams, cultural centers, trades unions, and others. In Canada, the online zero waste shop, Reimagine Company, declared itself an apartheid-free zone and urged others to join. In the arts world, many thousands of artists have joined together to endorse calls from Palestinian artists for Israel's apartheid regime to be held to account under international law, and in many cases have pledged to uphold the cultural boycott of Israel, as we've heard. So let's take forward this momentum and launch ever more strategic, effective, and impactful BDS campaigns to end international complicity in Israel's regime of apartheid, occupation, and settler colonialism, and to achieve true freedom, justice, and equality for the Palestinian people. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Samir Askanda, who is a Palestinian musician and activist who's very active with the BDS movement, based in the UK, and has worked on many global BDS campaigns coordinating links between organizing around Palestinian human rights globally. There's been a really important interface between social activists and some global institutions. Human Rights Watch was mentioned this year, which published a report outlining their study around the reality in occupied being Palestine being described as apartheid. Our next panelist, I think, is part of a translation and a study of the reality in occupied Palestine that is being translated within some global institutions. Michael Link is an associate professor at the Faculty of Law in Western University in London, Ontario, and is the special rapporteur for human rights, the human rights situation in the Palestinian territories occupied since 1967 for the United Nations. So the next speaker is Michael. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us today here on this Zoom webinar hosted by Alternatives, but also a live broadcast on CKUT across Montreal.
Thank you very much for that introduction, Stefan. If people will bear with me, I'm going to show a PowerPoint. I'm not dead sure how that plays on radio, but we'll see. My presentation will focus on Canadian foreign policy towards the Israeli occupation of Palestine, and bring in what international law winds up saying about the settlements, which are the engine of the occupation. If I can begin actually with a very recent statement, a surprising starting point. 2 weeks ago, the former Secretary General of the United Nations, Ban Ki-moon, published a remarkable essay in the Financial Times. This is, I think, part of the promotion for his recent released memoir of his time as Secretary General, where he spoke of, I got two quotes there, he spoke of Israel's incremental de facto annexation of the Palestinian territories to the point, he says, where the prospect of a two-state solution has all but vanished. He also goes on to say that that there's a lack of any international legal accountability, which allows Israel to ignore the volume of UN Security Council, General Assembly, and Human Rights Council resolutions regarding the illegality of various aspects of its occupation. He also said the following. He said that the situation in the occupied Palestinian territory arguably resembles apartheid. He pointed to the fundamental asymmetry in power between Israel and the Palestinians. And he applauded the idea of the formal investigation that was recently announced in the winter by the International Criminal Court And he says this investigation into potential war crimes committed in Palestine is so important, and it gives ground for modest hope. I want to look at the enormous gap between Canada's foreign policy, its official policy, and actually how it winds up applying that policy with respect to the occupation. What I have on the screen is a summary, and this is in the exact language of the Canada's official foreign policy. It states that it believes in Israel's right to live in peace. It believes in the Palestinian right to self-determination. It doesn't recognize Israel's unilateral annexation of East Jerusalem. It talks about a just solution to the Palestinian refugee issue, and in fact mentions the key resolutions with respect to this that have been adopted by the United Nations. It doesn't recognize permanent Israeli control over the territories occupied in 1967, including the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and the Gaza Strip. It says that the settlements are a violation of the 14th Geneva Convention, illegal under international law, and it opposes Israel's construction of a barrier inside the occupied territory. Looking at this on paper, our stated policy is not that bad. This was formulated in the 1990s and has largely remained unchanged. On the face of it, this should lead to a robust critique of Israel's conduct as the occupation has become indistinguishable from annexation and, say, some indistinguishable from apartheid. Yet, if you look at our practice, it's really something quite different. We have had a consistent policy over the last decade of voting against resolutions critical of Israel's occupation. Canada, in the years since 2011, cast 119 negative votes against these resolutions that were critical of the occupation. It didn't vote in favor of a single one until December of 2019, when it voted in favor of one resolution on Palestinian self-determination. And that was obviously because Canada was bidding for a Security Council seat in the elections that were held in June of 2020. I should point out that Canada was running against Norway and Ireland, who during that